Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to the Best of the MTJC podcast.
So hey everyone, welcome to episode 304 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And I'm also joined by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California. Alrighty then. So let's pick it up where we left off. So we were talking last week about the video. I think the cat's out of the bag now. I did see a screenshot of Craig Federighi doing the video. It was obviously shot at Apple Park, and as we've seen all of the videos this week that are in the WWDC pack, in case people haven't seen it by now, and you're living under a rock with Tammy. Apple Park is the backdrop for this thing. I was chatting with one of our friends of the show on our Slack today. We did a watch party today. So I did one with Tammy and Alexis yesterday, and I did one today. And this sort of the idea that, you know, when you went to WWDC, you would sort of, you know, make new friends and you would go to all the sessions together. And so we could have a friendly banter, right? So yeah, Ed and I were watching, today, and, we were talking about it almost looks, I wonder if there's like a virtual backdrop, but then I remember seeing one of the videos yesterday, there was like a glass wall and you could see shadows of people walking by. That's why I kind of figured this really is Apple Park that they're at. And he joked that maybe it was a really good effect that they did, you know. So that's a fact check from last week, that the iPad Pro rollout video from 3-4 weeks ago was done at Apple Park. So there you go. And we'll talk a bit more about that when we get to WWDC. There's a bit of health and safety I want to talk about on that. So, but we'll move on to our Ask MTJC. Do we have any Ask MTJC, Jaime?
We've got a couple. First one is from Greg Heo, who quite simply tweets the link to the XKCD comic on centripetal versus centrifugal force. Given it's technically follow up too, I guess, given our discussion of that last week.
Yeah.
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. Yes. Yes. I mean, for those of you driving at home, you know, Dr. Evil or whoever he is, and James Bond, he's got him in a big circular device of torture, and Bond is talking about, was it Bond who says that, you know, do you want me to die? You expect this centrifugal force to kill me? And
because Bond is mounted on the inside of a rotating circular thing.
Right, right.
So he is feeling centripetal force and believes that he feels the actually fictional force, centrifugal force.
I see, yeah. By the way, I did find, I think I talked to you guys about this on Slack, I can't remember, but I did find a video. So I did find that video that uses the big Lycra trampoline, and he puts the objects on and they bend the space, you know, space, the analogy of space-time warping. And there was another video that I found out after that where a scientist had a tennis ball on a string and he was spinning it around and he was sort of saying this was Newton's idea of what gravity was, that it was actually a ball on the string. But you know, Einstein came along with his relativity theory and proved that that's not the case because the guy let go of the string, of course, and the tennis ball went flying across in a straight line, like you said, right? But he also showed, you know, and it was an interesting place. He was in a science center somewhere, and they had a camera mounted above the table, and they could project a grid onto it, so you could see the grid bending, you know, to give you the visual analogy of a space bending, and running a ball around this heavy object, orbiting it, right? And when you looked from above, you saw what we see in all of our Earth projections, where the Earth goes around the sun, kind of thing, right? But you don't see the gravity well that's holding, you know, or attracting the orbiting object, right? So it's kind of cool. That, you know, depends on where you look at it from, right? And whether you can see the bend in space or not. That's my story about that. Anyway, so that's a link in I've linked that into last week's show notes, and maybe I'll link it again now that I mentioned it. So anyway, let's move on. What else we got, Jaime?
This one is from friend of the show, longtime listener, Sean Marston, who is replying to Greg Hio on a different tweet. And Greg has a photo that says, was here just a few weeks ago. Great choice.
Yeah.
WWDC 20. I'm assuming that's on the way to Big Sur.
I guess.
Because Sean's tweet is macOS BS. Not entirely sure that that was a good choice.
Well, it's funny you should say that. And because our friend, our other co-host, Tammy, kind of pointed out that maybe the word sir isn't the best sounding name given the current, you know, political and strifey climate that we're in, you know, because sir, you know, master sir, kind of
like it's too authoritarian.
Yeah, like Big Sur. If you didn't know, Big Sur was S-U-R, and I'm not sure is it why it's called Big Sur. Maybe Mark can illuminate us, but those crazy Californians, I tell you. But
you know, I actually don't know. Let me look that up.
So, but while you're on the subject, so
my assumption is that it's something in Spanish.
Okay,
let's see.
So while you're doing that, like, so I guess I, as a Californian, I have to ask you, what's the best way to get to Big Sur?
It depends where you're coming from. So, like anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
It's on the coast on Highway 1, which is kind of the coastal highway. It's not, it's a highway, but it's an old highway, so it's not like a big freeway. It's just the road that, you know, that winds up the coast. It's kind of a windy road.
So would I take the 401 to the 297 and down to number 1, or how would I get there?
There is no 401. There might be a 297, but anyway, there's no 401.
96, there you go.
401, if it did exist, would be on the East Coast.
Okay, right.
Because, well, okay, yeah, you're a Canadian, so I'll forgive
you. Well, did you know where I was going with the whole
here,
Californians thing, though?
I know, but I'm gonna school you here. So it depends on whether it's an interstate or a U.S. highway,
right, yeah,
and or a state highway for that matter. So the interstates, all the odd numbers go north south.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they actually do start in California. So I guess there could be a one interstate one. It's possible, but it doesn't exist because the lowest one is 5. When they built the interstate system, they're not really a grid, but they sort of are loosely following a pattern. The odd ones are north south, and they go 5, 15, 25, 35, 45, all the way up to 95, which goes up down the east coast, about 95. And the east west ones start from 10 down in on the, you know, close to the border with Mexico through Texas and all that, all the way up to 90, which is, you know, the Mass Pike eventually and Seattle.
So they all end with 5 and 0, or does that just happen to be where they started with?
All the interstates end with.
Maybe they started with 5 and then gave themselves room between, right?
No, they don't. They don't all end with 5 or 0. No, they can. There are some that end with 7s and things like that. But the odd and even thing is 100% for sure. Now, here's the other interesting thing: the first digit tells you something about what kind of road it is. And by what kind, I mean if it's a 1 or a 2 digit, those are like the main base roads, like the 5. That's a long road that goes all the way up from the Mexico border all the way up to Seattle. That's a long, long single road. And 90 goes all the way from Seattle to Boston. So the one and two digit ones are all like that. They go more or less across the country in some direction, either north, south, or east, west. But then the three digit ones, the first digit means something.
Mm-hmm.
So if it starts with a four, then it's a road that goes around a major city.
Okay, like a bypass. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A one is a road that takes you into a major city.
Okay.
And I forget exactly what a two is, but a two is something similar as well. And a two is in six. Yeah. Anyway, okay. That's your geography lesson for the day.
Thank you. We have a similar system like that in Canada. Maybe someday I'll tell you about it. All right.
I threw a link in to the Wikipedia entry for Big Sur. The etymology of the name is slightly more complicated than I want to go into in the show. It is indeed Spanish from a longer Spanish name. Sur meaning south, being the most important part.
Right.
And there's a few roundabout things about it being a big south area, and eventually it was named Big Sur officially in 1915. And now I see from the same article, attractions, the Big Bixby Creek Bridge is where
Mr. Hio was. At. Look at that. The Bixby Bridge. Yeah. Yes.
Known for its very pleasing aesthetics. So it's one of the most popular bridges in the area.
Cool. All right. Yes, Greg's been running around with his camera again. All right, cool.
So if you do want to get to Big Sur, though, because that's what you originally asked, from the Bay Area.
With air quotes, I asked, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, from the Bay Area, what you would do is you would somehow get over to the coast, Route 1, and just drive south.
Okay, cool.
On Route 1. From L.A., you'd drive north.
You know what? It's funny that you say that, because we did do that once, Caroline. We went down Highway 1 to somewhere and checked this. Yeah. And we ended up in Monterey, I think. And what's the place with the boardwalk and the I think it was like a roller coaster and
well, it's a lot of places like that, but you're probably thinking of Santa Cruz.
Yeah, just on the way down to Monterey. Yeah.
Or as Californians tend to say, Santa Cruz, like Santa Claus.
Santa Cruz.
Yeah. But I think the correct pronunciation is more like Santa Cruz or something like that. Santa Cruz.
Okay, all right.
Well, Jaime, you could probably tell us better, right?
Yeah.
Santa Cruz. But that's being said with more of a Mexican-Spanish sort of flavor on it. You would, if you were going to do it, what I assume the way the Spanish conquistadors would have done, it would have kind of a lisping th.
Like th? Like Santa Barcelona? Cruz,
right? Like think about Antonio Banderas and Santa his Cruz? Accent in yeah, Manila. Yeah.
Right. Well, I learned to say Barcelona when I was in Barcelona. Moving on. So, following up. Oh, yes. This is interesting. And I know a few people over at Shopify, but it was announced on the by our Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, announced that coming soon, there will be a COVID-19 contact tracing app that is, you know, endorsed by Canada and used by Canada and whatever. I believe it's built using the Apple and Google sort of framework, as it were. But what was more interesting to me was that it was built by a couple of volunteer coders over at Shopify in, I believe, I'm going to say Ottawa, Canada. That's where their head office is, but they're obviously all working from home right now, and some of them are in Toronto and various places like that. But yeah, just a COVID-19 app coming in July, I believe, called COVID Shield, is developed by our pals over at Shopify. In fact, one of our friends of the show, Dan, who just joined us last week on the Friends of the Soul Slack, he works for Shopify as a manager. So yeah, cool.
Great.
Cool. Looking at their open source project, so it looks like the apps for iOS and Android are built in React Native, which definitely makes sense given that you'd have less pain trying to get multi-platform support. And the server is a mixture of Go and Ruby, although don't understand what the Ruby is there for. It looks like for testing purposes, because the server itself looks like it's predominantly Go.
The other thing, too, that I forgot to mention, too, is that they've actually put the code up on GitHub. So I don't know. I guess that means you could take it, download it, and build it yourself. But
is the link in this article?
Somewhere? Yeah, at the very bottom it says find out more, and it takes you over to the GitHub.
To covidshield.app, which is a nice little microsite that they've created for this that explains what it is, how exposure notification APIs work, and also, very critically, that you cannot download or use this app as is, because you may remember both Apple and Google are going to be approving these, and there's limitations mostly around one per country. Your mileage or kilometrage may vary depending on your particular country, but it's not like, random person in their basement's app they can get get approved for many reasons. But I think this is really cool because this goes along the lines of like, why does every country even need to make its own app? That seems kind of silly. Surely you might have your own configurations. You might say, hey, you know, we want to direct people to like your country's version of the Centers for Disease Control and et cetera, official resources. But the main, you know, sort of basis of the app itself seems like, yeah, we really should have open source for this and not reinvent the wheel, you know, hundreds of times for this. So, you know, kudos to these folks for doing that.
But if you do get rejected, at least you can now appeal.
All right. You have our sympathies too, of course. Yes. Yeah. All right. So, Hamid, you got some follow up for us?
Yeah, I'm calling this follow up on. I'm sure we've talked about ARM based stuff before, and spoilers are the later part of this episode. But it was interesting that, given the recent news, that the Japanese supercomputer that is ARM based is now the fastest in the world.
Really?
Nice.
Fugaku, a computer in Kobe. I don't know what that means. I have to look it up.
Kobe is a place.
I know Kobe is a place. I don't know what Fugaku is.
Hmm.
Off to Google.
Set to go operational next fiscal year.
If the word ends with ku, that means like, I mean, that's an old word, name for city. So I guess it would be sort of a neighborhood of a city now, but or maybe it means town, something like that. Hmm. Something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, Google didn't give me a good translation. So I guess it is named after like a town or some sort.
Yep.
More ARM stuff coming later on in the show. All right, where are we here? Yeah, so are we at the big recap now? What do you think?
We are.
We just dig in. All right, so for those of you living under a rock, this week is WWDC. And so we had the keynote on Monday, and I think we all partook in that. And I'm going to say I've probably watched a bunch of videos, but I have a feeling that Mark and Jaime have not had a chance to look at too many of them yet. As I mentioned earlier...
That is correct.
As I mentioned earlier, we did a fun kind of thing. I was on another Slack channel chatting with Alexis, and he came along and said, hey, is there any watch parties around? And I sort of mentioned the Paul Hudson link, and I went over and signed up. I can't remember. I think I did hear back from them, but I'm not quite sure how that worked. But anyway, so Tammy sort of piped up and said, hey, I'd like to do that right now. So the three of us went over to fired up a Zoom call and agreed to download a video at the same time, and in sync, you know, went 1, 2, 3 and clicked a button. And I got to say, my favorite feature of the videos is the hit the rewind 15 seconds button. I use that one a lot, but the rules of our little watch party were that we weren't allowed to do that. And so I had to suffer through as if I was watching it live, you know, kind of thing, right? So, but it was interesting hearing the banter.
Which videos did you watch?
So we watched, we watched the What's New in Swift, and we watched something else. But I wanted to watch the What's New in Swift UI, but I got vetoed. But I did watch that one later on that night, and I'm going to say that so far was my most enlightening video so far. Let me just see if I can find it.
Swift UI, you said?
The What's New in Swift UI. I'll talk about that. Yeah. A bit, but and yeah, I remember, and I told you like, oh yeah, the What's New in Swift one was pretty much a recap of what we've already covered on the show with what Paul Hudson had on Unraveled and what we've been talking about on Swift.org. This, you know, I think Jaime mentioned a couple of articles couple of weeks where we talked about the new features, right? I don't know if you guys have watched it yet, but it was very much a repeat of that kind of stuff. So if you've already gone through and seen what's on Swift.org, I don't think there's anything really earth-shattering in the What's New for Swift, which is a, you know, surprise to say that after like 5 years of What's New in Swift being like sort of the one you go to kind of thing, right?
That's actually a really good sign because it means that Swift has finally settled down and matured as a language, and they won't be making crazy changes every year that force you to refactor everything and breaks your app and breaks your builds. So I'm actually happy about that.
So let me jump over to the developer app, because then I thought earlier that today that I saw that there was a section called Watch It Again, which I thought was keeping track of what I had actually watched. But continue watching. Yeah. Because it's surprising that continue watching works really well, because you can actually, I got called upstairs by Carol, and so I grabbed my iPad and I was able to pick up where I left off, right? So let me look at my favorites. That's probably how I can tell. But let's see. So I watched the visual editing with SwiftUI, which it was a good one. It's 5 minutes minutes long. Like, some of them are interesting because their talks are only 5 minutes long. I guess we should maybe start with the keynote first, right? I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. Because one thing I really enjoyed about the keynote was the fact that you didn't have to wait for people to walk across the stage, you know, plus all the demos worked and everything like that. So, yeah, let's talk about the keynote.
Some time savings. You know what the biggest time saving was? Not seeing one of those lame demos from some random company that just sucks all the life out of the room.
Yeah.
I mean, I kid a little bit. Yeah. It's a little harsh for me to say it that way, but let's be honest. You know, it was nicer not having the like 10 up sometimes 15 minutes of that going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have to say, I didn't miss all the playing to the crowd that they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That they normally do, like, you know, all of the, isn't this the most awesome thing you've ever seen?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they do a lot of that kind of stuff and, you know, yeah, whatever. You say that every year. just give us the goods.
Yeah.
So I was happy about that.
I think I'd also say, beyond the polished aspect in that, every single demo works first time, every time, of course, because mm-hmm. they can edit if it didn't. And that's really nice. It certainly avoids the, oh no, like Face ID didn't work properly kind of, you know, live demo that can go wrong. And I also think that it was pretty nice that they had a much more diverse, in many, you know, different ways to define that, a much more diverse set of presenters. And it wasn't like the same five people that we always see. Those five people were like there, don't get me wrong, but they included a much broader group of people. And I would say that the ability to not have to worry about, oh my gosh, can this person handle being on a stage with millions of people watching mm-hmm. at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
And will they get their 5 minutes correct? Not as much of a concern.
They can redo a part if they get it wrong, and they can edit it after the fact.
Yeah, exactly. And I paid attention to the cuts. You really only had to be good for like 30 seconds, and then you could completely fall apart, and then they can give you a coffee, and then you could start again for the next part. And I think that's brilliant, because I saw all sorts of people, let's say like job titles. I was like, they would never let this person normally just run out into the stage unless they were really clear that they had practiced really well and they were going to be able to handle the pressure. So I think that's a huge kudos. You know, certainly I saw more women. I saw more people with different abilities. So we talked about walking on the stage. There was somebody who had mobility issues. It looked like he had like a fancy wheelchair of some sort. That would have been rather difficult to do on stage. And then we had other folks who were you know, people of color, people who were not just the director of blah, 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 not just the manager. It's like, oh, this is like an engineer who worked on this. So that's really cool. I applaud them for that. I didn't see many people talking about it, which I think is a bummer, because Apple, I think rightfully so, has been, you know, beat up over this topic. And I think this year they got a lot better at it, and hopefully they'll continue to improve.
I don't want to forget about this, but did you guys have you watched any of the videos? There's a recap thing they do every day that there's a emoji named Serenity comes up.
Serena. Oh, Serenity.
Serenity. Yeah, that's right. Serenity Caldwell.
I have been watching those.
That's Serenity Caldwell.
Who's that?
She's a Canadian former podcaster, now works for Apple.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So she's been out there for a while. Anyway, so yeah. So
And now she's just an emoji. I mean,
emoji. Yeah.
She's not a real person anymore.
Well, her name's Serenity, and it sounds like her voice. So I haven't really sort of, nobody's called it out, but I just happened to notice it today when I watched one of them. So yeah. So
they uploaded her into a server on her first day of work, and no one's ever seen her since.
Well, yeah, I saw her. We played together at the Break Notes last year, because she was one of the background singers on James Dempsey. Oh,
okay.
By the way, as we record, like an hour ago, the James Dempsey song premiered for WWDC. The Somewhere Near WWDC is the show he does every year at WWDC. So this year we did a virtual one. I haven't seen it yet because I was busy with things. But a couple of things here. Like, let's talk about some of the numbers off the top. We always ask this question, and here it is: 23 million developers, right? Which is one of the numbers we're always trying to clamor for when we're doing the show. Of course, 100 plus sessions. Craig Federighi came in and talked about iOS 14. No surprises. I think we'd heard that the home screen was going to get a redo. They've added widgets now, which are sort of like, I guess they're coming over from the idea of what we see on the watch in terms
terms of like notifications and small little sort of snippets of things. So you can and we're seeing this in the iPad OS where you've got the sidebar and you've got sort of like what do you call those things on the that are on the bottom of your phone? And you can edit them and add them. It's like anyway, they're widgets, I guess, right? All written in Swift, by the way, Swift UI, I believe, right?
Swift UI,
yeah. They've added folders in there, picture-in-picture video, which is something people have asked for on the phone for a long time, and also picture-in-picture on Apple TV, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, apparently it's available everywhere now, yeah. Which is kind of nice.
Which I think a lot of what we're seeing too, and especially in like the Apple Developer app, is I think we're seeing catalysts all over the place, right? So things coming all over the place, and I'll talk a bit about that when we get to the Swift UI, what's new in Swift UI too. You can group things into like, I guess, sort of folders. Not folders, but there's a new metaphor.
I kind of like that.
Yeah,
you can the app library.
And you can hide entire things. And app library, right. Yeah. And it'll suggest things. Like, it'll time of day or time of year. When you use things more frequently, they'll come and suggest the groupings for you, which is nice. I kind of like that when I'm searching for things in my phone. You know, when you do the...
I have apps on my phone that I can only find them.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I have ones that I haven't used in 10 years, sure. But there are other apps that I use all the time. The only way I can possibly find them is by doing a search, by pulling down and typing it in or seeing that it's suggested. If I ever try to actually search for it and find it, I can't find it.
No, I don't know. I have thousands of probably, I don't know, like I'm going to guess and say over 1,000 apps on my phone, right? And there's some I have, like, and some I haven't even touched in years too, which is another thing too.
Remember back in the day, there was a app review site called 148?
Maybe.
Because that was the number of app slots that you had on your phone. And
oh, really?
Oh, I do remember something. Yeah. Real early on, yeah.
Hmm.
That was real early on, yeah. That was probably 2009, 2010.
Wow, cool. So, yeah, widgets on the home screen. So we got, data-rich, different sizes. There's like a today view.
And the thing I thought about the widgets was the way they describe them and the way they appear to work, particularly with the smart stack. Boy almighty, does that remind me of glances on the watch, right?
Did anybody get that? That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Impression? It definitely felt like if you understood or vaguely remember how that worked, I think you'll be halfway there for understanding how this works. And I haven't even seen the session yet.
Did glances go away? I can't remember.
Glances
did go away. They did go away. Yeah, they did go away.
Right.
But there's some analogies here where I use my different watch faces on my watch sort of like a smart stack, like a manual smart stack, right? I'll say, okay, I'm going to do this very particular task. Okay, I've got a watch face that has some complications for that. I have, I'm at work. Cool. I have a watch face that I like to use for work. I have a different watch face that I like to use for non-work or weekend time. And that works pretty well. Now, if they could
automagically
do that for me, that would be great. And that's what I'm interpreting the smart stack for these widgets to be.
Yeah,
you can info there, glanceable, and then it can intelligently figure out when you need the right information.
Well, do you not notice now on your phone that when you go to search for things during different times of the day, different icons are sort of suggested at the top? This is shortcuts, I think, doing under the hood doing this, right? So they're building on that kind of technology, right? Or that sort of power.
It's very judgy. I'm like, I'll go to search as like, open Twitter? I'm like, oh, all right. Thanks for telling me. I don't even see. This is why I don't activate the how long have you been using these apps? I know I've been using them too much.
Yeah. Anyway, so moving on. So the Siri is no longer going to be a full screen thing, which is great. It's now going to be a little bubble at the bottom, kind of like HAL 9000. But interesting stats there. 25 billion requests a month of that people are asking Siri questions,
It's good to be the default, right? Like, you have to go out of your way if you wanted to use Amazon's or Google's equivalent. It's definitely nice to have the basic part of it that everybody's going to use work.
And they finally added the universal translator to the iPhone. So now that Siri and machine learning and natural language engine can interpret what you said and translate it into another language, and apparently all on the device. So it's not actually going into the cloud to do the translation, which I think is super cool. That's really neat. What else do they do? Yeah, conversations. And that's a different kind of... Was that what they're calling messages now? They've sort of
glommed it in. I think you were talking about the fact you can pin conversations and you can at mention people.
Yeah, it's still the messages app, but you, like you mentioned, you can pin conversations so that they stay at the top of the list. Like, I think the example they brought up is, you know, your family or friends that you normally, you know, have a group one for, like, your entire family. You know, what are we eating for dinner tonight? Oh, I don't know. Let's get pizza. You know, that sort of thing. You don't have to go digging through the list of all of the other conversations you had. And they had some nice things there.
And can you recall messages? I think we talked about that, but did they actually bring that one up?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't see that. But yeah, there may be something in there, but yeah, I don't know.
Threading for inline replies is pretty nice.
Yep.
Yeah, Craig didn't say anything recallable, so I mean, memorable but not recallable. Do we have to talk about Memoji? Here's the thing. Every single speaker introduction video has a Memoji of them before they show the actual person on the screen. And I think Mark, you talked about this before, that in previous WWDC, when you saw the videos, you didn't see the actual speaker, right?
In the early years, you never did.
Yeah.
Yeah, now you do a lot.
Yeah, now they've got like a sort of picture-in-picture thing with the speaker there, and sometimes they're full screen, again, with a gorgeous Apple Park drop backdrop and all that kind of stuff, too. Yeah, so Memoji, I'm going to say this, 1 trillion ways to customize your Memoji. I still think it's not enough. Not a big fan of them, but face coverings have come to Memoji, which makes, you know, interesting sense, right? And woohoo!
Yeah, they call it face coverings, which like, what do you mean? Like eye patches? No, these are face masks, the kind that you would be wearing.
There are other kinds of face coverings too, though, that predate, and some of them are controversial, but they predate the COVID, right? So I wonder if they didn't have those in before, right?
I mean, I just thought it was a weird term because the one that they showed was.
Yeah, the surgical
type mask. You know, it has that style to it. So definitely leaning into the realities of the pandemic and this WWDC live online only remote edition.
Yeah. So they've redone the map for you guys in the U.S. United States of America. So you've got this really new cool map that they rolled out a month or so ago. Apparently, they're saying more accurate. It has the look around feature, which is what the Street View is what Google calls it, but they have look around. Mm-hmm. They're claiming privacy again. Like it's all sort of happening, you know, within the device and that kind of stuff. Like the routes you take, they're not sent up to some cloud somewhere telling you what the traffic patterns are. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And apparently they're going to add UK and Canada soon. Woo-hoo.
And Ireland.
Yeah, I missed Ireland. Sorry,
I
Ireland.
I didn't pick
Sorry.
Up Canada.
Sorry, Ireland. Well, I got stuck on Canada. What can I say? The other cool thing is cycling. So Meg Frost is one of the presenters you talked about. Talked about cycling and how when you do a route, now you can do a route, obviously, and it'll take you on the bike path and stuff like that, but you can decide whether or not you can look at the elevation you're going to be riding, decide whether or not that's too steep and maybe you want another route. It'll tell you if you have to carry your bike up a set of stairs. I guess that's important in San Francisco, but you know, you can sort of look at that, which is kind of cool. And also for EV or electronic vehicles, or what do you call them? What do you call these? Electric vehicles, right?
Hybrids.
Who have range anxiety, which is a new term, they can tell you based on the model of your car or the make of your car which routes to take, so you'll always have a charger somewhere along the route that you can charge your car, right? So do you guys know anybody who has electric cars, like Teslas?
Yes.
So,
yep.
How long does it take to charge one of these babies?
Like, depends what kind you have. Tesla has these superpower stations that you can you can fully charge a thing in like an hour or two.
Oh, so it's not like going to the gas station and getting like a tank of gas and you're out in 20 minutes, right?
Well, the superpower one actually probably is. Okay. I think even when I said an hour or two, that's probably too long for the superpower one.
Okay.
Because I think the intention is that it is like going to a gas station. But normally, a regular one, I think people generally will just kind of plug it in overnight.
Yeah, trickle charge,
overnight.
Okay, cool. And so another thing about the driving, which is kind of cool, is we don't do this here in Toronto. We probably should have congestion zones, right? And as some, like China, they mentioned specifically, and I think they showed a map of Paris. I know Paris is, I've driven in Paris during rush hour. It's horrible. So they have congestion, and they can tell you whether you're going into a congestion area, or if you want to go to green zones, which are
to sort of control the amount of polluting that cars are doing. And one of the benefits of COVID right now is we're not doing as much polluting to the environment, since we're doing less driving and less, you know, boating around in Venice and things like that. But, oh yeah, so, and what's cool is that if you're in China, you apparently have to, you can add your license plate, your license to the app, and it'll tell you whether or not you're allowed to go into the congestion area on your prescribed day, whatever that is, odd or even days. I don't know how they do it down there, but that's kind of cool that they can actually manage that kind of stuff. It's something we need in Toronto, because we have a lot of people driving into the city. I'm sure most metropolises do, right? Have a lot of issues with cars coming in and plugging up the roads, right? During normal times, not COVID times, but right.
Yeah, and I definitely would like the option of adding my driver's license to my phone. I wouldn't want to replace the physical license, but having it as a backup. Oh no, I forgot my wallet. Well, it doesn't matter. I've got my phone.
So we're adding. So here's another angle too. We're adding our car insurance thing. You can carry it digitally on your phone now. But here's a following up from last week, right? So if a cop asks you for your license and you have to use Face ID to open your phone, are you not handing them now an open phone?
Yeah, that is a consideration, which is why I don't want my license to only be on my phone.
Okay,
And it's even better if it was available like the emergency contact sort of card. You know, if they find you passed out on the street, they can figure out that you're, you know, allergic to penicillin or etc.
Sure.
I think something like that would be useful for the reasons that you just hinted at there.
So we always kid about the dongles, and Emily Sherbert came on and talked about the most expensive dongle that we've seen so far, which is the BMW 5 Series.
Yeah.
And that's a dongle for what feature, guys? Talked about last week, keyless entry.
Did they give it a brand name?
Yeah, they didn't say keyless entry, but that's what I have in my notes. So maybe that's what they start and unlock your car, stored in the secure element. You can share keys with people. You can also restrict the key you give to somebody. Like if you want to give it to a teenager, you can say no highway driving for you, young man. I don't know what that'll do. It won't go on the highway or something, but, or maybe it'll drive, like it'll only work between certain hours and that kind of stuff. Right. So, and apparently this is also going to be backwardly compatible with iOS 13, which is kind of cool, right? This car.
Yeah. That is pretty nice. Actually.
Super nice.
And apparently they're working on standards with other manufacturers. They're using the U1 chip for this, which has some sort of spatial awareness built into it. That will be able to use. So it won't be the BMW dongle won't be the only dongle you'll have to buy for this to use this feature.
Yeah, the U1 chip, I should say, is pretty nice, because it sounds like you can just leave your phone in the bag or pocket. You can still continue to start the car, even if you don't put it on the fancy little recharging pad that the BMW 5 Series has. But I understand, even though they didn't talk about this, that people who know this sort of thing are claiming that, it probably is also a way to help reduce the possibility of replay attacks that people can do, with like, you know, get a signal from, you know, intercept a signal between your car and your device, and then when you're away from the car, replay that signal to enter into your car, right? Like cloning your key fob. In this case, it'd be like, well, your phone is nowhere near, we can't detect the U1 chip, but therefore we should not open the car, is what I believe that's being used for, in addition to the user nicety of not having to pull the phone out and put it in a certain place. It also seems, from my understanding, to be related to security as well.
So 12 years ago, Apple opened the App Store, and the new feature on the App Store is the App Clip, which is like a snippet of code that runs or basically brings. It's kind of like the banner thing. I'm not quite 100% sure on this yet, but it brings a portion of some information from your app to the phone, and I think you can download it. When you hit open, it downloads the app. Is that what I'm understanding correctly? Do you guys know?
I think the idea is that you trigger it in a you know, one of a various number of ways, like scanning a QR code or getting a link through Safari or you know, or through a text message, or maybe even be in some location, or you know, with NFC or something like that, and it triggers it, and then this little mini app will download, because it's very small, download and pop up and let you just see some relevant content from the app without actually having to download and install the entire app from from the App Store. And then if you do like it, you know, maybe it's just enough to you just interact with it and you're done. But if you do like the app or want to do more with the app, then you tap a button and it will go and actually install it from the App Store and do more.
Nice, cool. Yeah.
So it's a little bit like an extension, except an extension that you don't actually have to have the original app installed to use. And I think it's more, my sense is that they're meant to be more media rich than extensions generally are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's very similar to app slices or instant apps from the Android side of the house. There are some differences in that, you know, this is really focused on getting you not having to actually do much of anything to interact, right? So signing with Apple so you don't have to create a new account. Even with nice things like 1Password existing, this can still be a hassle. But using Sign with Apple, you've got a, you know, one-touch login button, very similar to logging in with Facebook or Google. And you've also got Apple Pay, so you don't even have to worry about, oh, I've got to type in my credit card information. No, you don't. You just use Apple Pay to pay. So you've solved a lot of the problems you would have with, like, oh, I really just want to pay for this parking meter, which is the one that they brought up as an example, right? There's dozens of those apps. I always have to look at the graphic every once in a while to see, like, do I have the right app or do I need to download another one? Well, it would be nice to just have a clip, which apparently they are less than 10 megabytes in size, not very difficult to get. Even out in the street. And apparently you can also continue going on, like Mark mentioned, with, you know, it's not just this separate little app. It is a part of your app that you can have out there that people can go download as well and presumably pick up where you left off. I think this will be, or at least it has the potential to be very similar to Apple Pay, which Apple Pay was not first for NFC payments, but really dragged the whole industry forward a lot faster than it had been, even though the Android side had NFC payments for a long time. The instant apps have been around for quite a while, like 3 years maybe by now. As far as I can tell, they're not really a huge deal. Why? Because I think the incentive, if you're a company, is, well, cool, we can do this one cool thing for Android. Can we do it for iOS? No. Well, it's not bothering, right? Because we're not going to have feature parity. Now this has feature parity. So people say, hey, you know, the experience we would design for an instant app on Android, that's pretty much the same experience we would design for an app clip on iOS. And I think there's going to be a whole bunch of these things being created just because of that. You know, things are like, hey, well, we planned, you know, 3 years ago to do this and we couldn't. I was like, yeah, because people want parity, right? No product manager necessarily wants, like, hey, here's this thing I can do on just one platform, right? And if you were going to pick a platform, you're probably going to pick iOS because people tend to have bigger wallets when they can afford, you know, $45,000 dongles for their phone, right? This is where the money is. So I'm not saying that it should be that way. I'm just saying it is that way. So I'm pretty excited about this one. I fully expect that there will be tons of, you know, conference talks about, you know, architecting your app for app clips, because it'll be good practice, I think, right? Breaking your app up into smaller reusable modules so you don't go nuts trying to rebuild your entire interface just for the clip.
Cool. All right. So moving on, we have the iPad. They're talking a lot about this. I watched the Designing for iPad session today. Very distinct experience is what Apple's expecting to have. They've got the pencil availability. They've got the LiDAR for the AR kit and gaming kind of stuff. The LiDAR sensor on the back of the thing. They're talking about now designing for the iPad specifically. Like, again, I personally was an iPad first developer back in 2010 when it first came out. That's the reason why I got into iOS. But Josh Schaefer, he's the iPad guy, showed up and talked about the new photo browser with this new sort of, and he talked about the sidebar a lot, which is, this is a thing where it seems to be unique to, what they're saying is unique to iPad, and it's sort of like the split view controller we used to use back in the day. You can now have content-rich stuff on the sidebar. It's sort of like we have in the Notes app where you've got your notes listed, but you can also open up another panel to the left of it, which shows all of the sort of content you have in the cloud and all that kind of stuff, right? So giving you another area where you can either, if you're in landscape or portrait mode, you can swipe in from the left and have a whole series of information there, always visible, kind of like we do with mail, where you have like the folders. I'm talking about the mail in the app on the Mac, where you have mail folders and you have your messages in a sort of list view, and then you have the actual message you're currently reading kind of thing. So they're looking at that kind of experience coming to the iPad as well. well, or being capable. They're also getting out of the way of the user, like a lot, like I talked about earlier, with Siri being sort of a full screen experience is now just a little sort of thought bubble at the bottom. They're talking about, like, if you get a phone call, or I don't take many calls on my iPad, but if a call comes in, it'll now be a smaller area of the screen real estate. Or if you're in renaming a photo, for instance, they won't, you know, bring up an entire dialog box that blocks the whole modal experience, you know, modally blocks everything else. So it'll just be like a label becomes active or becomes a text message or text view underneath an image, and you can see all the other images on the page while you rename this one particular one image. So that's kind of cool. And searching, like right now I can do search on the iPad, but again, it's a full screen thing where, you know, you kind of drag down from the top of the screen and you start typing in your search terms. Now it's more like Spotlight, which I've got the term right this time, Greg. Now it's like Spotlight on the Mac, where you've got the lozenge and you type in what you're looking for, and then it suggests things to you, right? So that's kind of cool. But for me, the big thing was they've added the Newton OS into, I mean, sorry, they've added handwriting into, handwriting recognition into the iPad. I'm a huge pencil user, and I would probably use my pencil more if now that we've got this Scribble technology, where you can write in cursive or in letter style, and it will automatically, interpret what you've written and turn it into text, which, you know, sort of Sherlock's our friends over at Nemo who made an app, a note-taking app for doing exactly that thing too, right?
Scribble was actually on the Palm Pilot though, wasn't it?
Scribble, maybe. They had this thing called Graffiti. Yeah. They had a thing called Graffiti.
Oh, was it Graffiti?
So yeah, Newton's handwriting wasn't very good. Palm had this way of writing what they called Graffiti, where you had these ligatures you would make, and the ligatures represented a letter. So you had to learn to write the ligature too. Like, it was called Graffito or Graffiti.
It was like writing in shorthand.
Yeah.
But, and there's a lot of people under 40 looking around saying, what the hell is shorthand?
Exactly. They're calling it Scribble, and it's basically write anywhere on the screen. Like, if a text field is active, you can write anywhere on the screen. It will then take the text or take your scribbled characters, interpret them, and put the text into the text view for you, which is kind of cool. But it also recognizes Chinese, which I think is huge for that, for the, you know, the Asian market of, you know, Korean and Chinese and all the various, you know, character-driven languages, right? So that's kind of cool. I'm really happy about that one. I joked about it by posting a picture of my Newton going, Apple's finally added handwriting. But we want to move on to AirPods Pro, which apparently are things that some people buy. None of us have an AirPod Pro in this group of developers here, right? Do we? No?
I do not. Been considering it, but I think I'm going to wait.
The cool thing is they've added spatial audio to AirPods Pro, which is kind of neat. You can maybe, now we don't have to go to the movie theater to get that, you know, the awesome sounds. They're supporting 5.1, 7.1, and they're also supporting Dolby Atmos with that. That's kind of cool. They talked about the watch. Kevin Lynch came out and talked about the watch. Again, I don't know what was Surfwatch about. I made a note of that. I can't remember. Is that about surfing and Glow Baby and Run Club? I don't remember why I wrote those down.
Yeah, I don't remember that either.
You can share watch faces now, which I didn't know was a thing or a thing that people wanted. Better maps on watch. It's the cycling stuff again, with I was talking about before with the phone. In the iPhone, you can have like cycling courses and gives you elevation and navigation. It even shows you where repair shops are during your cycling session. Another lady named Jules, I didn't catch her last name, came out and talked about the workout. So here's something. I love Carol. She's a dancer, right? And she's always told me, and I believe her because, you know, she told me that dancing is a lot of work. It's very strenuous. It's right up there with athletic, any kind of athletic pursuit. It's a lot of energy, you know, a lot of exercising required, and it's very intense. They finally added dance to the workout app. So, and they've renamed the workout app. They're calling it
what are they calling it now?
Fitness.
Fitness, thank you. So yeah, it's cool because it can track whether you're moving your upper arms, how your arms are moving, and also how you move your legs, and so vertical and horizontal arm moving and lower body movement, which I didn't catch the name of. And of course, as soon as I told her that, she says, yeah, but they don't have, what's it called? Aquafit. Apparently she goes and does, she has this thing where she gets in the water and they do exercises in the water, and her complaint is that her watch won't recognize that as exercise. So you can't win, is my point, is why I'm telling you this part of the story here. So you can't win. Anyway, but yeah, so I think it's cool that they've added dance to, I'm sure dancers around the world are rejoicing. They're doing, you know, pas de deux and pirouettes and all that kind of stuff around this news. Also adding to the watch, they've added, is this the watch? I believe so. The sleep tracking or the sleep mode. They're adding in new experiences in terms of you can set a schedule. Like you can say, hey, I want to have like 7 hours or 8 hours of sleep a night. I need to get up to go to work at such and such a time. It will remind you to go to bed at a certain point in time, as opposed to just letting you stay up and watch WWDC videos. It'll prompt you to go to sleep and then keep track of how you're doing in sleep mode as well, right? And a simplified face for when you're sleeping. This story got a lot of attention. Hand washing is now a feature in the watch. Kind of timely, you know, I suppose.
Do you actually wear your watch while you're washing your hands, or do you take it off?
I wash my hands with my watch on. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't take mine off to wash my hands.
It's waterproof, man.
You put it in your pocket.
I guess it's waterproof.
Well, do you wash all the way up your forearms, or what? Like how?
These days, I do.
Yeah, okay.
And go with the doctor style. Yeah, I'd have to take it off and put it in my pocket if that was the case.
Do you? Yeah, I used to do it when I was washing the dishes, but I've since learned that I can actually wash dishes without getting my entire hand in the water, right? So, I've been washing my hands with my watch on like an animal. But apparently the app will sense whether or not it hears running water, so it knows that you're in doing the activity of washing your hands, so...
With a handy countdown, so you don't have to do whatever it is you do to.
You're not to sing happy birthday anymore, or
no? I've stopped doing that the happy birthday twice thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I went with the DuckTales theme music. And
you weren't doing the Rip Roll song.
No, I don't know where to stop on that one.
Mm. Yeah, you can't stop. I know that's the problem.
but the DuckTales one, good, right? it's easy. After the third woo-hoo, then you're done.
Oh yeah,
okay. If you're like me and remember that show from the 80s, or I guess the revival, the reboot here in the 2010s, I think it started last year in the 2019, you'll no longer have to do that and be really good at keeping time to do that. Now you can just let your watch tell you. I guess it gives you like a notification or a buzz of some sort.
Yeah, it gives you a little happy sound and you get...
So now you don't even have to know how to count to 15. Woohoo!
Yeah. And you get points for exercising your hands. So the other thing they talked about was Apple privacy. Of course, they talked about built in, how it's built in. We've talked about this many times on the show. Data minimalization, in other words, not the data that gets sent off the phone is not is the minimal amount they need. Using on device intelligence is secure and transparent. They're also being transparent about what they're doing with your device, your information. So again, like your cycling routes and all that kind of stuff, whatever gets sent to Apple is not identifiable. It's not, you know, it's just a minimal amount of information that they would need to do what they need to do to tell you what they need to tell you. The other cool thing they talked about was sign in with Apple, which I thought was kind of cool. Like 200 million accounts on sign in with Apple already. Kayak alone. Kayak is, a reservation system, or hotels, yep. Right? They have twice as many customers that use sign in with Apple when they sign with that service, which is kind of cool. Which is coming is that you will be able to convert existing logins to sign in with Apple. So like if you have, I mean, when I see it, I tend to use it, but again, I get to have that goofy double Apple ID thing. But yeah, if I've been using it a lot lately when I see it now, and I'm seeing it more on my Mac and on my iPad and stuff like that, which is kind of cool. So yeah, that's neat. Oh, apps now have to ask if they're going to track you, right?
If you're capturing information about their users, Apple developers now have to go in and tell Apple, like, there's a new requirement on App Store Connect where you have to tell your users what you're tracking about them, right? Do you guys cut that part, right?
Yeah, it's this new App Store policy, but it's weird because it's self-reported.
Yeah.
which, I mean...
You'll be fine.
the good thing is that Apple, the good side of Apple being able to just hit people over with a hammer is if they discover that you're not self-reporting correctly, they can and will remove you from the App Store just to teach you a lesson, right? They have that ability to do that. So it's kind of in your best interest to follow their nutrition label metaphor and mark things appropriately. And they talked about the microphone and camera usage will now show up in the status bar, very similar to the way that location services, when an app fires that up, you get to know. And that's a pretty good one because, yeah, you know, it's pretty reasonable. Like, oh yeah, you know, this app is all about, you know, recording voice memos. So I sure would like to have it access the microphone. True, but only when I'm actively using that feature. It shouldn't therefore be able to just listen willy-nilly when I have the app open, but I'm not using it, right? That's creepy and weird. So I like the fact that they've added this.
Yeah, and you can see the privacy statement on apps before they're downloaded to, before you download it to your device. So I can't tell you the number of times over the years I've downloaded an app that I didn't intend to want to create an account on a server of some type or whatever, only to find out after I downloaded it that I had to create an account to some sort of third party. Yeah, so I have tons of apps in my graveyard of a phone looking for suggestions as to where to put them. HomeKit. So yeah, Home, they're working with third parties. They're now creating an alliance with Amazon and Google. I have tons of devices here. We try to buy things for HomeKit, but sometimes we have things that aren't. So hopefully they'll start to get more and more across. They've open sourced HomeKit so that people can start writing for it specifically. So I guess because it's sort of a, I don't know if you guys noticed at all, if you have any electronic devices like home devices or home automation devices, there seems to be three camps right now: Amazon, Google, or Apple. Some of the Amazon and Google tend to work together a lot, but HomeKit's sort of been the orphan in a sense. So I guess this is one of the reasons why they're doing this. New things in lighting, where the lighting can be adaptive. It can have a different kind of color during the morning when you're trying to wake up, and change, you know, take blue out of the color when you're winding down at night. Cameras that are used in HomeKit. There's a lot of end-to-end encryption in HomeKit built in, so that, you know, cameras information is private. You can now use contacts, like if you have a doorbell or door camera, it'll recognize people who you have designated through facial recognition from your photos and your contacts, which is kind of cool. Apple TV, be able to resume. This is an interesting one. You can now have multiple users on Apple TV, right, for switching between games. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that 100% makes sense, and it made a lot of people upset that you're unable to do the same for your iPad.
Oh, really?
In
yes.
The classroom experience. Gotta fork out your money, kids. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty nice that, you know, you can set up different game profiles, because it just makes sense to be able to switch between those profiles, right? You know, pretty nice that they're also... Did you mention the live view of who's at your door related to HomeKit?
Well, I was just talking about the facial recognition, but I didn't necessarily call it specifically that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so when you're watching Apple TV Plus and somebody comes to your door, you can see a little picture-in-picture of, like, who
oh,
is
this
that?
Is, oh, on your okay. Apple TV. Oh, I see.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool. Nice. Yep. Cool. And so the Big Sur story is Mac OS, obviously. This one goes to 11, as Mark joked during the keynote, and I totally missed it.
I didn't make that joke, though.
Who made
I was just pointing out that I noticed on the slide that they said it was version 11.
Oh, did they?
And I was asking about it, but I didn't make the goes to 11 joke. Somebody else did.
I technically didn't either. I just said that people need to start cranking up the Spinal Tap memes,
which means, like, it goes now to 11. Hello.
Yeah.
I technically did,
by the letter of the law here, did not make
I saw your comment on Slack, and I went, what does that mean? What did I miss?
I made the meta comments about the presumed existence of said jokes.
Yes. Well, I missed the numbering, but I did eventually catch up with you guys after a bit
They didn't call it out. It was like you had to really
I was on the
see,
slide
blink and you miss it sort of thing. saying on the screenshot as it came out of, so, you know, here's what the system is.
We were talking about this on the release notes happy hour thing just a few minutes ago before the show, that, what, 1999 is when beta came out for Mac OS X, as it was called back then. Don't at me.
Wasn't it before that? I don't remember.
It was around 99. So it's been pretty much 20 years that we've been, or 10 years? How many?
Yeah, 20 years. That's 20.
20 years. 20 years that we've had Mac OS X, and now we've finally got to 11. So, yeah, and which, I mean, they could have gone to 11.
And
yeah.
Did you notice that they wrote it out as the numeral 11?
Oh, they didn't do XI?
XI.
Oh.
Yep. Right.
That's because I'm old and I wouldn't be able to make that transition, Mark. Sorry. Yeah, so new design. So I don't know if you noticed, but I'm calling it skeuomorphic because it's kind of got shadows now and it's got shape on the icons. And I noticed that some of the new...
It was 2001 that it was first released.
Okay, 10.0. Close enough. I was off by 2 years. It's like a Microsoft error.
Final release of Mac OS 9 was in 1999.
Oh, okay. I knew it was around there somewhere. Okay, 2001. Yeah. All right. When was the beta?
Well, it would have been probably early 2001 or maybe 2000.
Yeah, I think.
Because if they released it in March... Yeah, it was released in March 2001, so it would have been 2000 probably.
Yeah, yeah. Because it was like a six-month or nine-month beta, right?
Yeah.
And you had to pay $99 to get it. I noticed that some of the behaviors in the menus seem to be behaving like the iPad that we've been having when you roll your cursor over or your mouse over them. They sort of transform the same way that, and they highlight the same way that Apple TV or the iPad OS does, which is kind of cool. Control Center on the Mac, coming to the Mac. I'm not sure we didn't sort of have that already with this. I guess it's a quicker way to get to things, right? Like, I use Control Center on my iPad all the time.
Yeah, I mean, in the fact that it's customizable is nice, too.
Yeah, right.
As I've got, you know, a whole bunch of, I forget what these things are called in the upper, like, in the status bar, it's like Charms or some other similar name. I have a whole bunch of these little icons, like, oh, you know, here's my Bluetooth status. Here is, you know, my Time Machine status. Here's, like, a whole bunch of that stuff could go away if I had a really easy Control Center-like place to put it.
So, have you used the app called Bartender 3, which is basically the same idea? You can group and hide these little icons across your screen, because, like, if you're doing presentation video, sometimes they're distracting, so you can use Bartender to hide them. Anyway, that's another app.
I've heard of it, but not used it.
That's been Sherlocked by this feature. I mean, mind you, many things have been over the years have been Sherlocked.
You mean it's been spotlighted by that feature?
Spotlighted.
No, I'm just messing.
Yes, you are. Yes, he's messing with me, Jake Bragg. Help me. So the new maps is coming over to Mac OS 10.
Not 10. We have to get away from
11,
saying that.
It'll 11. Yeah,
just Mac OS. Now.
Yes, Mac OS.
Big Sur.
Mac OS. Yes, yeah. Coming to a Mac OS to a near you. Yeah, it's got the indoor maps is kind of cool too. If you can go to a mall, which apparently now we can, you could sort of go and see, look at an indoor map and find out where things are. They've changed the name to Mac Catalyst. I don't know if you guys caught that. And an example they used for Mac Catalyst was the Swift Playgrounds app on Mac. They could have also used the app developer app, but I guess that's another story. So it's a Catalyst example. They're calling Safari.
You know, it makes you wonder, does anyone really need Catalyst anymore if all of these apps are going to run natively on the new hardware?
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah. I've seen a lot of discussion.
I think you guys are skipping ahead. But yeah.
No, all right.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I mean, even if we didn't have the part of the discussion that's going to come after we talk about Safari, it's kind of a weird bit of timing for Catalyst, given that it came out when Swift UI came out, which sort of like, well, yeah, it's a little less painful to do Catalyst in order to get over to Mac. But if you have the option of going Swift UI, you probably should just start with Swift UI in iOS 13.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think even doubly more so in iOS 14.
We're going to get to that in a minute,
and
too.
Mac OS, where like they doubled down even more on things like the widgets. So I think Catalyst is probably like a necessary stepping stone, but I don't think that it would... I don't think it'll have a very long life for Swift UI and topic after Safari reasons.
All right. Since we're there, Safari, they're calling Safari the world's fastest desktop browser. Do you guys believe that? I don't know. They're saying 50% faster than Chrome. I don't know.
They say that a lot. There's some benchmark they do where it's faster. Yeah. Maybe Google does some other benchmark and then Chrome's faster or something like that. Hard to say.
Yeah, they're saying also that it was the first browser to have privacy, cookies, blocking, and blocking tracking as well, ad tracking.
I think that is true.
Okay. Yeah, no, I do remember that. So, yeah, they did a privacy report on Safari. I can't remember where I wrote that down. Oh, monitors. Oh, yes, they're now adding monitoring safe passwords, which is a feature in 1Password. I don't know if that's true in LastPass and those tools, but like that's one of the things it'll tell you when you've been pwned, as it were. Have I been pwned? They're extending web extensions, new Catalyst app for the maps.
They're implementing the web extensions API, which
right.
I know Firefox does. I don't know if Chrome does. So that's nice. You'll be able to add extensions using that open standard. They're not particular to Safari. And it's pretty cool that they added the fact that you can limit which sites extensions have access to instead of giving them access to everything. Mm-hmm. And you can choose time-limited access, which is nice.
Yes.
That's really cool.
Just a day, just the site, or always allow.
Well, what I'm wondering is Chrome has a feature where you go to a page that's not in your native language. It will prompt you and say, would you like me to translate this
right.
page for
yes.
you?
Yes.
Is that what that feature is for Safari?
Maybe. I might cut it. We'll see. So then we came back to Tim Cook again, which tells us we're coming up to the big announcement of the day, the one more thing kind of thing. And that is, of course, which we've talked about many, many times. He talked about the three major transitions that have happened over the years with Apple. One was going to PowerPC, one was going to Intel, and I can't remember what the third one was. I mean, we've been talking about this last 3 weeks, right? Anyway, they're calling it, they didn't call it ARM by its name, they called it Apple Silicon, right?
Right, arm wrestling Intel with Apple Silicon would be the headline if I was at the newspaper.
Right. 10 generations of ARM chips that they've had over the years. They started with iPhone first and then iPad. Retina needed a custom chip, so they went to that. And then Apple's A5X started the translation to this stuff. 100 times faster, 1,000 times faster graphics over the years. Lower power for the Apple Watch is another requirement that needed, so they built their own chip for that. And 2 billion, it says 2 billion SOC, so that's 2 billion system on a chip. What does that mean again, Mark?
2 billion transistors.
Transistors.
So a system on a chip is a term that's been around for a long time. Even when I was in the semiconductor industry, it was around. It's in the early days of chips, you would have a chip would be something that had a certain purpose. And if you wanted to make a big circuit, you'd wire a bunch of chips up all in the same, either on a circuit board or sometimes in the same package or whatever. And then someone had the idea of, well, wait a minute, we can make a bigger chip that does more than one thing. So you put a whole system of things all on a single chip. So you have a bunch of, you can conceptually think of it as a bunch of little chips all on one chip that are connected to each other. So they call that a system on a chip, kind of a buzzword. In this context, it usually means like there's a microprocessor, there's memory, there's GPU, there's a radio being the Wi-Fi or Bluetooth radio all on the same chip. They'll call that a system on a chip.
Cool. Yeah. So, they needed a secure enclave as well. Advanced powering. They wanted more you want high performance and low power is what they sort of said in their little chart. So they're trying to, target.
Which is hard to do.
Yeah. Hard to do. But apparently they're going to try and do it.
Because I think I told you guys last week that power is proportional to switching speed of transistors. Mm-hmm. So to get high performance, you need fast speed. But normally when you do that, you have to increase the power. So to get both low power and high speed is pretty tough.
Right. So now, once they get the Mac onto this new Apple Silicon, they'll be able to have native apps for all the things. So their apps can be ported over now using Xcode 12. And it has an option. If you start an app from scratch, you can build a universal app which will run across all the devices like Mac, iPad, iOS, Apple TV, and Watch as well. So you can build with one single code base that will will address them, and they'll take care of the sort of what happens in the background. It's going to be running. They currently have the A12Z Bionic chip with its universal memory architecture and neural engines, and they talked about Rosetta 2, which we talked about Rosetta before, being the tool that let us run PowerPC apps on Intel. Is that right? What we used Rosetta for, Mark?
Well, there was I think the classic. Well, it was when they went from 68,000 to PowerPC, and that was, I believe, that was Carbon. Right, that was Carbon.
Rosetta was PowerPC to Intel.
Yeah. But wasn't it Carbon was the one that went from Classic to PowerPC?
Yeah, we had Cocoa and Carbon back then. Yes, exactly.
Right. Yep.
So this translates faster than the current one. It translates all the code automatically on the fly. And it's going to allow for new virtualizations like Linux and Docker as well. Andreas Wendker came on and talked about the new Kickstart program that they're going to have, where you'll basically get a Mac Mini with an A12Z chip in it, 16 gigs of memory, 512 gigabyte space or SSD, and you can apply today, and they're calling it the Developer Translation Kit. And interestingly enough, on that sidebar on that one, I did apply for Pi Day Countdown. No, I'm kidding, it wasn't Pi Day Countdown, but I did apply and I got accepted, and I've talked to two Mac bona fide Mac developers in today who have not heard from Apple yet as whether they've been approved. So I think it's kind of sort of a lottery again. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
But the idea is you have to spend, I think it's $500 US to get the hardware. You keep it for a year, you build your apps on it, and then you have to return it after the year is over. So
did they give you your $500 back at the end?
No.
No.
I don't think so.
What do they do if you don't return it?
I don't know. Come to your house and take your house away.
He's like, oh, remember your Apple ID?
So I have 7 days to decide whether I'm going to pay the $600 and get the thing. But to be honest with you, I don't think I would make that much money on an app that I would make. So I don't know if I would. It might take me a few years, I guess, to make it back. But yeah, so that's the story of WWDC, or the keynote for me anyway. Any comments?
Pretty much summed it up.
Yeah. I think I'm going to advise people, because you know what's going to happen. As soon as these kits hit the streets, you know people are going to very quickly, using beta software, try to write benchmarks to see, how does this thing perform? Let me tell you two things. One, this summer is, beta software, and it doesn't necessarily have all the performance enhancements. Mm-hmm. You're the first seeds, you're in the middle, it's towards the end. And the other thing I'd say is that A12Z processor is almost certainly not the processor they're going to be shipping the first ARM-based Mac with later this year, because why would they, right? Why would you give up the secret sauce to Intel to be able to grab one of these and run benchmarks? You don't want Intel to know where you have to hit for performance to match. You want them to be sweating out exactly how big of a change in performance is it going to be. So I think the actual processor will be better in performance than the A12Z.
Well, they probably haven't made the actual processor yet, to be honest, or finished it. I mean, don't get me wrong, these things take 2 to 3 years to actually make, so it's close to being done, but it's probably not being really manufactured yet. It's probably still being finalized.
Yeah,
well, that's my guess.
So the current A12 is in the new phones and the iPads, right?
The A12 Bionic, I think.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the new one that's going into
the real, the A13
right.
order.
The real one.
This is just a stopover. Oh, I mean, they had Intel Macs when they were developing for Intel as well, even though they didn't tell half of us, very many of us. Anyway, so the next big story, of course, was from the same day on Monday, was the Platform State of the Union.
I'll be totally honest, a big part of it was spent on the ARM transition.
Mm-hmm. Too much.
A huge part of it.
I think maybe a little too much, because I think even though in some ways this touches everyone, it's not really super hyper relevant content for the overwhelming majority of developers.
Right.
And it's not to downplay it, but I just think it took a little too much time. So I'm going to go through what I have here. So recapping the keynote, by the way, you can replace Safari and Mail as your default apps on iOS.
Woohoo.
That was on a slide somewhere in the keynote, but definitely was not highlighted. So it'd be nice. They've created the Find My program at developer.apple.com/findmy. So other apps and companies can join in the fun of, I need to find this thing. Well, cool. They'll have a way to do that.
Well, I can probably do a device tracker. Hey.
yeah, exactly. Or if you're a Tile and you have sued Apple for their inability to have that sort of feature, like, I guess that lawsuit goes away, but moving on. Of course, they talked about Apple Silicon silicon. They talked about Universal 2. You'd mentioned the Universal App thing that has Intel and Apple Silicon-based architectures in a single app. Xcode builds for your native architecture during development, because that would be the faster one. But then you can choose a new AnyMac with Apple Silicon and Intel as the options. If you want to do that, you can use an update and build option, which presumably will get you, like a lot of these migrations, a lot of the way towards being able to have your app be available. And they claim for many apps, just a few engineering days, they showed how OpenCV, Chromium, Blender, Unity, and a whole bunch of other open source programs are up and running, I believe, on using Universal 2. Then they also talked about Rosetta 2, which has ahead of time performance translation. So I believe at install time is where they're tending to prefer doing that, to just take the hit the one time when you're installing the app to do the translation. But they've also got dynamic translation for the just-in-time type purposes, like JavaScript running on in your browser. And even though they didn't state this, I would guess probably for WebAssembly as well, which is a burgeoning web technology that I think we've mentioned on the show, but I don't want to spend too much time. We noted in our Slack channel that they talked about Swift for Linux running on Parallels Desktop, and they used Vapor as their example. So that was pretty neat to see. What have I got about Mac Catalyst here? Apps are in applications folder by default, but you can rename and also move out of the folder. But they've got some sort of, looks like an archive structure. I didn't write good notes here, but he said, like, you know, iOS apps don't expect to be moved out of their place, but they've got something that proxies that for your app, so your app doesn't freak out. And you can use iOS extensions as is on macOS, which is pretty nice. Moving down to macOS Big Sur, I think they'd recapped a bit about notifications shown grouped together for the same apps, very similar to the way you'd see on iOS or iPadOS. Sheets float above a window and are dimmed, so going along with that new design language that they're using, the more unified look and feel across Mac and iOS. They spent a fair amount of time talking about toolbars sitting atop content, the colorful SF symbols, so SF symbols 2, I think is what they called, did they give a version? I knew it's noted somehow that it's different. And of course that this is macOS version 11. Let's see, looking at iPadOS. iPadOS 14 has sidebars.
And sidebars. Color picker. Don't forget sidebar.
Yeah. Sidebars within your sidebars. Color picker.
Yo, dog, I put sidebars in my sidebars.
They did mention the depth API and the LiDAR sensor from iPad Pro. Pencil Kit got some love, especially the text entry with Scribble. So that's pretty cool. Moving to iOS, they did some recap on the widgets and app clips. Notably, the widgets are written in Swift UI. So I think if that sort of answers the question of, like, when should you start learning? If you haven't started learning now, now would be a pretty good time, because it's clearly not this thing you're dabbling with, right? It is a... You can't do it in Objective-C, so let that be your guide.
I can't do it in Swift either.
Yeah, I mean, not just, you know, plain old Swift with UI kit, for sure. So if you want to play in that game, you've got to learn Swift UI. And they talked about the fact that the way that the widgets work is they have a... I didn't actually write this note, but I do remember them talking about they're taking advantage of the descriptive nature of Swift UI. Like, oh, well, so then we can just archive your UI every once in a while. And then when we're asked to show it, we can just rehydrate that and tell the GPU, hey, just directly show this you know, sticker version of my content, and then can update appropriately. So they don't have to fire up your app all the time to do that.
Is that widgets you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. And then they talked about the...
Yeah, there's a timeline, yeah, so that you don't have to have the spinning wheel or that, what do they call it, thing that Facebook does. Shimmer?
Yeah. Yeah, and the widget protocol and the timeline provider stuff, this is the part that definitely reminded me of glances on watchOS.
Yeah.
Possibly it was called WatchKit. I don't remember where that was in history.
I think that was WatchKit. I think that was very early on, early days.
Okay, that was my suspicion. Yeah. App clips, talking about that. So the app card is nicely auto-generated by your app store metadata. The app is already downloading in the background by the time the user has ended up triggering the system to do so, right? So if they've scanned the QR code, for example, and it's showing you the UI, like, hey, this is what that will be. It's like, cool, we're already downloading this in the background. As mentioned earlier, we don't have to manually sign up or add your credit card data, because you can just use sign up to Apple and use Apple Pay. You can open from apps that you use every day, for, as Mark mentioned, like through your QR codes or sharing a link in Safari, etc. Uses native SDK, less than 10 megabytes. They very notably said, leave out analytics SDKs you don't really need, which I feel like was some unnecessary shade, but sure, all right.
Yeah, it was kind of surprising that they pointed that out. It almost was like that was on purpose, right? Everything's on purpose in this. So I've suspected for a little while now, for various reasons, that Apple is planning their own analytics library sometime in the future, so that they can get everyone off of Google Analytics or Firebase or Mixpanel or anything else. But we'll see.
Yeah. They also mentioned that you can use notifications and you can have a 8-hour permission for notification. I think you're set to 8 hours permission for notifications. I don't remember if they talked about this in the session or if I just heard it elsewhere, but I think the pretty good rationale is going back to that parking meter example. Like, all right, I've paid for the parking meter. Sure would be nice to get a notification like, hey, dummy, your time is about to run out. You should probably go move your car or pay some more.
Yeah.
That's great. Within an 8-hour period, that's cutting a little bit close for a work day, but sure, that's pretty good.
Oh, that's the max time. Okay.
I think it was the max time, but I haven't seen the sessions, but I think that's what they talk about. But that makes sense, right? Because 2 days later, if I'm not using that parking meter app clip, I don't want it spamming. Like, hey, have you tried our other parking meters? No, leave me alone, right? So if I want to go download
Can I unsubscribe? Yeah.
If I want to, and I got to go turn off the notifications and stuff. But along the lines of, if I truly did like the app, apparently you can add store kit sheets to drive app installs. So I can already see a whole bunch of ideas for what people will do with this. As we've talked about in probably our Slack channel, there probably will be people trying to do spammy things with this.
Yeah.
I would say don't. It really should be.
They said that in the video I watched today at the very end. They sort of said, yeah, just don't do that. Like, not specifically, but they implied that it's meant to be used, in moderation.
Yeah, and I think it's reasonable if you believe the user had a good experience, right? They tried your clip, they had some successful action, and then you're like, cool, would you like to have this permanently? And then let the user decide. You probably shouldn't bring it up as soon as your clip fires up, as if you're trying to, avoid the whole purpose of the clip, which is downloading a small part of an app just in time, just the little bits that you need. It's kind of like don't ask for push notification permissions as soon as I fire up your app for the very first time, because I don't know if I want to give you that permission. I think it'd be the same thing here. Don't shove a store kit sheet in my face. I was trying to use the clip, not download your app.
So you wait until they've ordered their first cup of soup before you get them on the app.
Yeah, I feel like that's a fair time to do it.
Yeah.
Referencing the soup thing that was the big rage last year.
The soup store, soup chef or soup store?
Everything was all about soup last year.
Yeah.
Has there been, Tim, you've watched more of the videos than we have, but has there been some kind of a common theme between all the sample apps?
There's a couple coming up. One is this book library thing that I've been watching. It's one of the things. And then another one was there's the one where they talk about the different collection views. That one seems to have a common theme as well. So there's been a few. I haven't quite got them all yet. Is that it for you, Jaime? You got more or no?
Well, the one last one in that section is app privacy. They talked about the data linked to you, the self-reporting for apps in the App Store.
Right, okay.
Wow, I guess I was getting salty by the time WatchOS 7 was mentioned. Here's literally my notes. Lol, who cares? They didn't show anything specific to watches, really. I guess complication stuff.
I wrote Swift UI complications in preview device. That's the only thing I've got. Yeah.
I did feel just in general that the platform State of the Union was a lot lower content.
This was an S year this was probably the least interesting platform State of the Union I've been to in like 10 years.
Yeah.
Normally they're packed with all kinds of insights and whatever, Like, I almost didn't write down Xcode document tabs because I was like, who cares? We already have tabs, right?
I took extensive notes for the keynote.
Yeah.
And then I switch over to my platform State of the Union notes.
Yeah.
I have three lines. Developer Transition Kit,
yeah.
Widgets, App Clips. and then I stopped.
Well, you can also,
and then I was done.
You can finally change the font size in the Project Navigator. That's one thing. That was like,
yeah, yeah, this whole always, yeah, novella for the keynote and this haiku for the platform. Yeah, say that you
right.
Yeah.
Well, a couple more, and then more right. Salts, which we'll get.
Okay.
As I'm reading ahead, so Xcode 12, you know, dynamic tab to show stuff as you move around, or you can open yeah. things in a new tab if you want to hang around.
Yeah.
New Swift UI app project templates that split up code for other platforms.
Yes.
You have XC tests that can now use scrolling velocity, so they added some more love for tests.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, StoreKit testing, including the StoreKit manager that shows details of what's going on with in-app purchases. So they helped solve what I understand to be a huge pain in the neck for people trying to debug what's going
on. Oh, yeah, yeah. Look with purchases. The virtual purchases. Yeah, for sure. Yep.
Yeah. And then they added views and modifiers that can appear in your library and from Swift packages too by adopting a protocol, which seemed like much fancier pants version of IP Designable for the stuff that you're creating with Swift UI, which is pretty mm-hmm. neat. And speaking of Swift UI, they definitely focused on source stability. So these improvements that they add are additive, meaning they will not break your existing source. They added the at main app struct to manage your app in a few lines of code. So you really don't need a whole bunch of other things. They've done a lot of the boilerplate for you if you do that. And we have long wanted, at least 1 year, as I say long here for Swift UI, you know, what's the collection view equivalent? And it turns out that you have this new lazy loading ability mm-hmm. for lists of stack views, and you can get that performance as it loads things on demand. And they have, my understanding, a lazy grid that is the correct. Equivalent yep. of collection view. I haven't seen that session, but it seemed like that's what they were saying.
Yes, grids. Grids are the new grids, yes. Collection views are taking over from table views. I watched a section on collection view and her video on that. That's coming up.
That's a long time coming, because when collection view came out in iOS 12, it's iOS 12. So what am I saying? 2012 in iOS 6.
So iOS 7, wasn't it? Maybe iOS 6.
It was 6 in 2012, I think.
I went to the session with the two guys from France who came up with it, and they got hired by yep. Apple, did their yep, presentation. Yep. It was a mess, right? Because it was something I was really interested in. I tried to get into collection views right off the get-go, but it's, you know, it's taken a long time, but like it's finally gotten to the point where it's funny now that we've got this, they've added a bunch of stuff to collection view this year, but they're also adding in this new grid metaphor for Swift UI. So going to be interesting to see who wins the day, right?
Yeah. I do remember yeah. thinking when at least collection view came out in 2012, iOS 6, I remember thinking, and I think I asked in one of the lab sessions and they didn't give a straight answer. I remember asking, so why would I use table view, why don't I just have a one-dimensional collection view? And I think the answer I got at the time was like, well, table view has a lot of performance enhancements because it can make assumptions that a collection view cannot.
Wait a second. Were you in the first talk where they first rolled out back in 2012?
Yeah, I was sitting in the audience, and I remember, you know, they talked about collection view and some of the things it did for, like, dequeuing. That was nice. And then they said, oh, by the way, we've done the same thing for table view, so dequeuing.
Because you know what? Nicer. I think I actually remember you asking that question, but I didn't know who you were.
You were that close.
I was in the audience. Yeah, yeah.
No,
were you sitting like maybe 10 rows back on the right hand side?
Possibly, but I don't think I asked this question to like the broader audience. This would have been in one of the lab.
In the lab. Okay.
Lab areas.
Yeah, somebody asked a question like that during the actual, the Q&A at the end of the talk, right? Don't you remember there was a Q&A at the end there?
I kind of vaguely remember that.
Anyway.
But yeah, it was neat.
Okay, so you weren't the guy. So you weren't the guy. Okay. So
no, that wasn't me. But I did ask at the lab. Like, you know.
That would have been serendipity for sure.
Yeah, yeah. The lab, the very last
thing. I'm going to
the
lab too now that I think about it. Yeah. Back then you could walk into the lab, so you didn't have to make appointments.
Yeah, I think it was first come, first serve that year. Under the more category in my notes, the very last line is, again, more salt. TVOS, lol, who cares? Nothing worth mentioning, I guess.
Well, there was one thing I caught in at the very end of the, wasn't actually talked about, but it was in the scroll screen at the end of it. Did you see that? No? Okay.
So no, I guess I didn't.
The last part of the show, you probably just all went off and had a beer or whatever, but the last part of the Platform State of the Union was a scroller that talked about health and safety. And they said that for everybody that was involved in the making of all of it, and this, I guess this applies to all of WWDC, they had daily health screenings They all practiced proper safe distances. Face coverings were used by everybody but the presenter, and the presenters were isolated when two presenters had to be on the same screen. They were isolated by considerable distances, and everything was sanitized to an inch of its life.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I did. And they showed that at the keynote, end
did
of the
they?
Keynote as
oh,
well.
Oh, okay, I didn't see the end of the keynote.
Yeah, that was the, you know, no animals were harmed in the making yes. of this movie sort yes. of thing, which I thought, you know, somebody said, you know what, we're going to get slammed. There's already people writing articles for Forbes who are just ready to submit. If we don't put this on there,
yeah.
we're going to get
Apple jeopardizes
hit.
Health of employees to make videos for...
Yeah, because it was clear they were in an actual physical location that was not the home. Home, right? As opposed to most of what Microsoft did for its Build conference. Not true, because they had, I think, two main hosts, socially distanced, but in like a studio of some sort. But everybody else was presenting from their presumed house, and very clearly people were not presenting for their house for the Apple content. And we get a couple of quick items that I put is sort of the just after. What wasn't mentioned in the keynote or the platform State of the Union? One is an iOS 14 accessibility option that lets you tap the back of your phone to launch apps and or run shortcuts. So you can double tap or triple tap on the back of your phone if you set up this option.
Oh, yeah. I saw somebody
like,
do a demo
of
that.
So you can fire up certain apps. You can't fire up the camera, but somebody say, hey, but I can write a shortcut that fires up the camera. Yes, you can.
Hmm.
You can set that as a workaround. So that's cool. They also have an iOS 14 feature.
So you can serendipitously take pictures of people without them knowing it?
I suppose so, in that case. But it could be used for other things too, right? So you really wanted some particular app to be even more readily accessible, you could have that fire up. You've also got a feature in iOS 14 that has your iPhone alert you if it hears certain sounds like dogs barking, a doorbell, or fire alarm. I believe this is an accessibility feature as well. But like a lot of accessibility features, it's not just for people who are impaired in some way, but generally usable for the public at large. So that's cool. And the single session that I actually did watch, because it's only 15 minutes, and it was on a topic that I was like, oh, that's cool. That's work-related. Safari is going to support passwordless logins via Face ID and Touch ID by implementing the platform authenticator flow for WebAuthn, which we've mentioned, I think, once or twice before on the show. So that's pretty cool that you'll be able to do that. And it's a very short video on how they're doing that. It's really nice, because you'll have even fewer opportunities for people to try to steal your password in some way. Well, they can't steal your password if all you ever did was use it the first time to register, and after that you're using your iPhone or your Mac, you know, biometric devices to log in. So that's really neat. Appreciated that. So those are the quick items that I mentioned that were things that weren't in the keynote or the platform State of the Union, but people have found as they've been poking around through the betas.
Cool. All right. So, here, let me just knock off a couple of things. So one of the things that I remember Mark was talking about collection view last year, because none of us really clued into the fact that we even talked about collection views. And there was a session that Mark went to about...
two sessions. One on the diffable data source.
And so
then the one on the composable
right,
collection
right.
views.
So this is what they've... Where that is now going, if you watch the collection view 2020 video, I don't know what it's called, what's new in collection view, I guess, or whatever. Lists, the list metaphor is now coming into collection view, that they brought from... Lists is how they handle table view sort of content or dynamic content in Swift UI. So that's coming into collection views. You've now got swipeable actions like we do with table views. It's sitting on top of that compositional layout thing that you were talking about last year, I think, right? And so the gist I got from this is that collection views are going to be replacing table views going forward, right? There's now a UI collection view list cell type. And I think maybe this is a note on going to watch the lists in collection view video that I meant to do for later. Cells are now registered the same, some very similar way that table view cells are done, like using a DQ configured reusable cell, a concrete type, I guess you call that. And then there's another one called modern cell configuration, which is a video to follow up on this one.
And also Advances in Diffable Data Source was another one that they recommended from watching the Collection View one. So that was, again, it was a quick, you know, I think it was like a 15-minute video as well. But for me, the big takeaway, I watched the Widget IDEO one, that was kind of interesting. But the big thing for me was in Swift UI, is that you can now build an entire app completely in Swift UI. Before, Swift UI apps were, they were sort of, there was a Swift component to it, like a, and you had just the content view part of the app, and you could have other Swift UI classes, but now there's a new app type, or app, I don't know if it's called a struct or whatever, but there's an app object which has a window group API that defines the interface that you're going to use. So there's like an app struct which owns this window group. And the windows then own scenes, and the scenes are what we build into Swift UI views. And there's a session called App Essentials on Swift UI, which is a follow-up video to this one. But
so there's no longer a top-level UI hosting view.
Right. Yeah.
UI hosting view controller.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and there's a new at main, yeah, which you now designate, which is going to be the primary view incoming when the app launches. This is the one that's got like a property wrapper called at main at the beginning of it. Is how you designate which is your first sort of view or first object that loads. You can now do settings. Scenes for Mac preferences using Swift UI, which is kind of cool. Document group. Blah, 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 blah. Oh yeah, they've added a document group object to handle documents with iPad apps can have documents. Mac apps can have documents as well. So there's document-based APIs. There's now a new in Xcode 12. There's now a new multi-platform project type template. Right. So you choose that, and basically it will set up, you write your generic or your declarative code in Swift UI, and that template or Xcode itself will handle how it behaves on the iPad, the Mac, the iOS device, and so on and so forth. So the idea is you basically can very simply create a multi-platform application doing just that one, using that one template. Launch screen now has an info plist, so it's no longer just a storyboard for the launch screen. You can now have a more stuff. You can have images and stuff like that in there as well to make it more interactive. Widgets, as we mentioned before, exclusively written in Swift UI, and so you basically build a Swift UI view for a widget. That's essentially how it happens. And there's a new state object property wrapper, I guess, that lets you manage the state of your views throughout the thing. So that's how it loads, keeps track of what the state was. So when you go to load a view that you previously had, it uses the state object to sort of reincarnate it, or whatever you want to call it. So definitely watch the what's new in Swift UI, despite what your friends are telling you. Go watch that one. That's a quite interesting video. So that's my first Swift UI story for the day. Oh, let's move on to the picks. My first pick here was a video that I found for Jaime that was, I forget where it was posted, but it's a song that a country singer has written called Up Here in Canada. It's very comical, and it talks about all the different facets of Canadianism. It says sorry a lot in the song and all that kind of stuff. So, So Jaime, you're next up with this. What's new in Swift UI for iOS 14?
Yeah, oh, yes. That's the name of the blog post by Mr. Paul Edson on hackingwithswift.com. If you haven't seen the session, like I hadn't, he's got the, you know, little bit of code, little nuggets of what is new, right? Like dealing with the multi-line editable text editor, using the lazy grids, as mentioned before, other nice improvements for property wrappers, and etc. Not really meant to replace the official documentation or the WWDC videos. But I think it's really nice of, like, you know, help me catch up on these things, especially because it's broken down into different sections and clickable links to very small. Here's your minimum amount of code you would need to get the point of what this thing is.
Cool. Yeah, I saw he did a live session after the Platform State of the Union. He went through a lot of stuff, and he just riffed off a whole bunch of things. He's on for about an hour. It was interesting to watch him. I was working on other things, but listening in the background with him talking about all the new things in Swift and 5.2, I think we're in now, right? And all that kind of stuff. So I got a bunch of links here that I forget who I found these from. But basically, yeah, it's like Swift UI, all the things is what I'm calling this, because there are Apple development documentation. I was sending this over to Tammy, actually, is what I was doing. I was asking her about SceneKit and SceneView, and I've got the same link in here twice, unfortunately. But yeah, so SceneKit has new stuff that hasn't had a lot of talk about SceneKit, but it's had a sort of a Swift UI, a bunch of underpinnings done in that one. And the other one, so SceneKit and what's this, the other one I'm thinking of? SpriteKit. SpriteKit also has had some Swift UI-isms or put into it as well. AVKit also has a new sort of Swift UI-based video player and for dealing with MIDI. Media, whether it's MP3s or movies and that kind of stuff. And of course, MapKit, which we've talked about a few times on this show, has also had a Swift UI overhaul as well, or added in new documentation on their mapping or maps for using in your apps. All right. So are you guys going to be watching any of the videos and stuff like that coming up, or are you planning to? Or
so luckily we have next week, we have our summer break.
Oh, cool.
Which means we're off from Wednesday through the end of the weekend because of the 4th of July holiday.
Okay, right.
So I plan to spend a whole bunch of that time watching some videos. But this week I might not get to watch too many. I actually have a pretty busy week.
That's true. I forgot we have Canada Day coming up on the 1st too.
Canada Day, yeah.
Yeah, looks like I planned my vacation correctly again. All right. So Jaime, what are you planning on doing for the rest of the week for WWDC?
I'm probably going to take a look at the list of things that are out, and I might even watch the recaps first, actually, the 2-minute recaps to see, you know, what came out that day and which ones should I target. Am I correct in thinking that they're releasing batches of videos day by day?
Yeah, they all come out at like 10 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. So, and it's weird because, you know, I've been going through the list and looking to see what I want to choose, and looking at the names of the sort of recap, I kind of go, I don't know, like I'm not really finding, you know, the love that I would normally find for certain subjects. But what I've been finding is that when I do go into some of them, they do highlight, you know, where to go and get more information. I watched one session a couple of times, like same speaker in two different sessions talking about the same app analogy and using the same sample app, and it was very repetitive. I watched one with Ed today, and that's what we found. We both found that this particular subject was sort of a recap of what we'd just seen, like in the survey one they did before, right? Just more detail and with a bit of code in there, kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. I'm still feeling it's kind of an S here in terms of it doesn't really feel like there's anything really substantive other than the Swift UI building an app, you know, from the ground up kind of thing, right? So what do you think?
I mean, remember last year when we were all complaining, oh no, there's too much stuff, and look how buggy iOS 13, and it was like 3 point releases in before it became not a hassle. I'm kind of okay with having that S year of like, all right, let's let things settle. I'm just going to assume that iOS 14 and macOS Big Sur will be much more solid in their betas, and hopefully therefore much more solid in their releases in September, because that'll be good. And as far as videos go, without having any sort of guidance whatsoever, I was probably going to lean towards the Swift UI ones myself, because I believe since last year that Swift UI was pretty much the future. And I think that turned out to be correct. We can, you know, quibble about the, you know, how quickly is it the future, and when, what does that mean for, you know, migrations of things, that sure. But I think Swift UI is definitely something that I want to get more familiar with, and particularly in combination with Combine, which I don't think I saw any news about. I'm sure there's new improvements, but it didn't seem to be a focus this year.
Yeah, so I guess the next question for you guys is, what do you think about this new format? I mean, do you think this is a format that Apple's going to continue to use over the next few years? Like, you know, like for them, WWDC is sort of a culmination of the year too. Like, they kind of, it's their showcase of every year, right? Like Macworld used to be. But do you think they're going to continue with this sort of canned experience? Why wouldn't they? I guess is the question, right? What do you think?
Well, there is some kind of cachet about doing it all in person, right? When you have 5 or 10,000 people just showing up in one place, you get a lot of press coverage, you get a lot of excitement generated. So there is something to having a live event. In terms of content transfer, I actually never thought WWDC was actually the best format for that. I always thought watching the videos was better than being there in person for getting the content. But you know, you can't argue with the press coverage and the excitement they generate and just the buzz that it builds having all those people in one place.
Yeah, that's true.
So I can see them going to that just for that sake. But on the other hand, you know, how much does Apple really get out of that? I don't know. I don't know, to be honest. They spend a lot of money on it, and it's hard to say. You know, a lot of their energy is spent building it and running it, which could theoretically be spent doing other things. So it's hard to say.
Well, I think they lucked out by this whole Apple TV experience that they've been, you know, now that they've been getting into television production, and they probably have a whole crew of people. They must have brought people up from LA or something, because I mean, like, the lighting is amazing. The video itself is amazing. It's like movie quality kind of stuff. I mean, it's even better than most television shows I watch, right? In terms of the quality. So from that point of view, I think it's been an excellent presentation, right? And the fact that you can have like a quick 5-minute video and a 10-minute video and a 15-minute video, and you don't have to sit through like a 40-minute session, you know, of boredom. I'm one of the things I used to do at WWDC when I used to go in person is I would go to I just randomly pick a subject, go into a room, realize 10 minutes into the talk that this is not for me, and get up and walk into another room and catch like the, you know, last 20 minutes of something else, right? And you know, I've stumbled across things that way that are amazing, or even seeing the sort of reference to check this other video out kind of thing, right, that I'm talking about today as well, right? I find that's interesting. The one thing that I've got to say, though, I really did enjoy the sort of randomness of the way that the release notes happy hour thing just worked was 160 people signed up and showed up, and I don't know what percentage of that showed up to this Zoom call, and then Charles and Joe just divided people randomly into rooms of five, and then so you chatted with them for, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, and that was kind of like, you know, standing in line and like, hey, what do you do, and hey, what do you do, and what do you think about COVID, and what do you think about grocery shopping, and you know, what kind of apps do you make, and that kind of thing, which is the kind of icebreaker stuff that I normally would ask when I go to a conference, right? That's essentially how Jaime and I met, and that's how you and I met, Mark. So that part's missing from this whole experience for me. Like, so definitely the going in person and hanging out with, you know, 5,000 other people who are kind of interested in the same thing that I am, right? That's, for people in Canada, that's pretty rare. I know down in San Francisco, you could, like I said to you, Mark, before, you can't swing a cat without hitting a developer, right? But
that's, you know, that's the Silicon Valley in general.
Yeah. But I mean, so it's nice to sort of see, but I mean, like, even in Silicon Valley in general, you're not always running into iOS people, right?
No, that's true.
Yeah, or Mac people or whatever. But what do you think, Jaime?
I think it'll be a very difficult decision for next year, because I think everything is, you know, pretty spot on that you and Marcus said about, you know, in terms of transferring knowledge, the way that they've done it this year, in many respects is superior to the way that normal stuff happens for WWDC. And would you say 23 million registered developers? So yeah, it's like the 5,000 who are blessed to go is like 0.2% of all developers.
Yeah.
It's never really about like disseminating the knowledge there. There is something to be said about the sort of Apple festival that it sort of is, that I wouldn't want to see them completely go away from. Maybe they'll have something a little different, right? Or I don't know. I could think of a million different things they might do differently than they normally have when they have the option of, you know, pulling people. And maybe it will be more festival type thing. Like, hey, let's all get together, let's watch this video. And then, you know, it could be a little bit more casual because you're not having to deal with a lot of the pomp and circumstances. Like, well, the video's pre-canned, right? You can watch it in this big auditorium and then, you know, have snacks and beers and whatever with all the developers. Oh, did you see that thing? How cool is Swift UI's new blah, blah, blah feature, right? Like, there's some aspect to that not everyone is willing to go, capable of going, or even gets the sort of opportunity. I haven't been in like 5 years, but that doesn't mean that I wouldn't ever want to go for like the more festival part of it, right? That could be a whole lot of fun. And having the ability to just say, hey, I'm just going to take this week and go do dub stuff is kind of nice. nice. It's a little harder now to not be like, well, I've got this other thing. I'll watch a video tomorrow. I'll watch a video during lunch, right? It's not quite the same as having dedicated focus of a week, even though hypothetically I could just do that. So I don't, it's a very long-winded way of saying, I don't know what they're going to do, but I do think it will be a very difficult decision next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, it's hard to say. I mean, it's sort of like have you ever read The Goblet of Fire or seen you saw the movies, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, the very beginning there where they go off to that festival thing where they use the boot and they all transport to this place and it's like everybody gathers together. I forget what they call that, but I'm sure the Harry Potter fans are just yelling at me right now. But
yeah, they had like the Quidditch Cup or something. It was like
and they all went there and the Death Eaters came in and ruined the party. But the sort of let's all just go and touch the boot and whip off to this, you know, thing. And Harry's like, what are you guys talking about, right? Sort of communal experience kind of thing. I think that's where what happened. And it's funny, because like I said, the very first time I got into iOS, like I thought, you know, I had already been going to conferences in Boston for there was a Macworld there. There was a thing called Siebold Publishing, which was a sort of a Siebold conference for people in print and ink on publishing or ink on paper publishing. And so I'd already had that experience of being, that was where you go to get the central, you know, font of knowledge kind of thing. And so I was at a conference in Seattle to Voices That Matter, and a friend of mine said, well, no, the real conference you need to go to is WWDC. And so that's when I applied the first year. And fortunately back then, you know, it was like, it took like 2 weeks for them to sell the tickets, right? So it was easy to get in. But that's when I discovered, like, yeah, there are like 5,000 other people like me who are doing the same thing that I'm interested in. And that's kind of a unique experience to be able to get that sort of all in one place, right? It's kind of like you do when you go to a football game or a basketball game or a baseball game. You're like, you're there with, you know, 10,000 other like-minded individuals who are either for or against the team you're rooting for, right? So that kind of, I think it drives at our sort of communal, tribal, you know, underpinnings, or, you know, our sort of our ancestral roots, right? To sort of gather together and you know, break bread and, you know, tell stories, right? Like podcasting. Anyway, I guess that's it for another week. Hi, May. If people want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
I'm on Twitter. It's @devwithahair.
All right. And Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
I'm at markr@smapsoft.com.
All right. My name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And if you're, I mean, we've had a handful of people join us on the Friends of the Show Slack. If you want to come by, just, you know, go to the website and check it out, or ping me or whatever, or Jaime or Mark, and we'll tell you how to get in and join us on Slack and talk about WWDC and all that kind of crazy stuff. Anyway, so by the time you hear this, it'll be over, unfortunately, but we'll continue the conversation. So,
we can talk about Buckethead instead.
We can talk about Buckethead. Yeah, there's always Buckethead, and yeah, we can talk about him for sure. All right, so yeah, till next time, we'll say bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
And that's it.
That's it. Looking at my notes, right. I realized you blew right past the Isaac Asimov's Foundation series on Apple TV Plus.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Yeah, we can talk about that. That's amazing. That's one of my favorite books, or series books, I guess. We've talked about them before.
Will it translate to the screen?
I don't know.
I don't know.
That's a tough one.
The clips that they were showing were really different from what I remember the books.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm afraid they're going to make it into like some kind of an action adventure sci-fi. And they just were not. They weren't like that.
No. They were
very cerebral.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the very first one was, or the first or second one was about trucking across space, right? Do you remember that?
Oh, I don't remember. I read them last probably 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
More than 30 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Maybe closer to 40 years ago. Damn. Old.
I can probably tell you when I started reading Foundation. Let me think about that. Would probably be... I think the first book I read of that whole series was probably Robots of Dawn. You know?
Oh, I started with the original series.
Yeah, no, I'm older than you, but I'm not that old. It was like university for me, so like it would have been like 86, maybe? So.
That's around the same time that I was reading them. Yeah. I was in high school at the time.
Yeah,
But I was reading them back then.
Yeah, because I started getting into Arthur C. Clarke and Heinlein, and yep. I think I read a lot of Heinlein before I read Robots of Dawn, so, yeah.
I also like Poole Anderson. You ever read him?
No.
Or Paul Anderson, I don't know how it's pronounced, but it was spelled P-O-U-L. And Michael Moorcock.
Never heard of them.
He wrote the Elric books.
Are they from the same sort of genre as Heinlein, Asimov, Clarke? Were they later guys?
Poole Anderson was same kind of genre. Moorcock was more like the swords and sorcery stuff.
Right, yeah. Did you ever read the Myth Adventures, Robert Asprin?
Yeah, I read those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. He did one like a few years ago. Like, he came back out of hiding and did one. Mm. Oh, those are quite good. With the dragon,
I remember
right?
reading the first few of them, and then they just kind of got old after a while, because it was an anthology series, you know, and after a while, if I'm thinking of the right one, it was an anthology. Wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a demon. There was a guy named one character was a demon, and he was a apprentice wizard, and he had this dragon.
Yeah. That I don't remember.
Yeah, the guy who Robert Asprin was the guy who wrote them, and he wrote two series of books. I think about it. Looking at it.
Thieves World, right?
Asprin. I mean, and they had this sort of underpinning in there. Yeah, American guy. Fool's Company. Yeah, I didn't read many of the Fool's Company, but I've read the Myth Adventures. There was and they were all myth, you know, Myth Inc. Link and Myth Inc. In Action, Hit or Myth. Yeah, it was one. Oh, he's just done Misfortunes. He did a bunch of them here. Mischief, a bunch of 2008 that he did. That I have not read. Yeah, I thought he went away for... Oh, yeah, so he came back. Myth Quoted was one in 2012. And then 2016 was Myth Fits. I don't know if I've read that one. Yeah, my son got me into those because he's read all of them. What sci-fi have you read, Jaime?
Ever? Recently? I can't think of anything I've read recently.
Yeah?
I think, well, back. I don't know. I don't use, like, Goodreads or anything, so I don't have a good list after I've
read. Did I tell you I applied for the developer kit and got accepted? Yeah, I did, right?
You did?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we listened to you.
Oh, thank you.
And now I'm just messing
with you. Tim, I think you absolutely should turn that into a conference talk.
What's that?
The using the developer transition kit.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, it gets a little bit more value out of the $500.
Yeah, I mean, I have 7 days to decide whether I want to continue with the application, right? Like, I'm surprised that, like, again, that people I know who are legit, like James Thompson, for instance, hasn't got one. Manton Reese, I was talking to him earlier today, he hasn't got one. So, like, when they're like legit Mac developers and they're not getting them, it doesn't make sense. It must be like a lottery or something, right? What do you think?
Maybe. I mean, it depends on how many people are signing up for the kits and if they're doing any sort of, you know, combing through for that sort of, you know, activity as an example.
But do you think it's like I've been pretty lucky. I got the developer watch. I got the developer Apple TV, right? I just wonder if there's like, because so far, somebody's telling me already that every Canadian they've talked to has gotten approved. So maybe it's a quota thing, like they're only sending so many to the States and so many to UK and whatever, but it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Maybe it is, you know, in batches of this batch, you know, this is the rubric that they're using. But then, you know, if somebody like a James Thompson didn't submit immediately, you know, maybe sat and thought about it for a while. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, well, you're in the second batch. And, well, sucks to be you because there's a whole bunch of other people who maybe met whatever the rubric was, right? Like, it's definitely a sort of thing where you don't want to sit and think about it if you're going to do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're only at an advantage to be in that list early because I don't know that they're, I don't know that they just say, well, first 500 people, and I don't think they're necessarily going to, you know, collect everybody, wait a little bit, see if any mm-hmm. stragglers go in, and then decide. I think it's probably on some rolling basis that they're doing it. Alrighty, all right. Till next time.
All right. Till next time.
Talk to you later.
Okay, later.
See you guys.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.